Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today's episode is brought to you by About Time We Met Skincare, and this stuff has been an absolute game changer for me, and I use it every single day. If you follow me on Instagram, you'd see that every day I have 14 daily habits that I try and tick off, and one of those daily habits is self-care, and About Time We Met has helped me so much with this over the last 6 months. So every night I use their foaming cleanser to try and wash off the day's kind of dirt and sunscreen and zinc and all that stuff that we end up on our face after a long day of just living life. So I use their foaming cleanser, and then I also use their Naturally Brilliant oil. This stuff is so nice. I put it on my skin, rub it all around, and it just soaks it all up. Smells so good, and it's also good for my mental health. So a few things that I love about Time We Met is it prides itself on its antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and antimicrobial properties, along with mental well-being benefits. It features sandalwood oil, which contains a key component called alpha-santalol that can help relax and calm your nervous system, and has been used for centuries in Ayurvedic meditation and practices. And also, studies have shown that when you apply sandalwood oil topically to your skin, this component can work in similar ways to any anxiety medication by interacting with the receptors in your brain to regulate anxiety. I absolutely love this stuff. I know you guys are going to love it too. If you head over to their website, abouttimewemet.com.au, you can use the code ACC15 for a big 15% off everything. I know you're going to love their stuff. It's a big part of my daily routine, and I know if you guys use it too, you're probably going to enjoy it. So check it out. Let me know what you think. Tag me and both About Time We Met on your social media. Would love to know what you think of it. This is Good Humans Podcast with me, Cooper Chapman, chatting to the world's best about the inspiring stories that got them to where they are today. What's going on, you good humans? Welcome to guest episode 145 of Good Humans Podcast with a very interesting guest and part of my 100 days to 100Ks challenge. It is Jack Ahern, and Jack is an ultra endurance runner. He has a mental health organization over in Bali, and he has a story unlike any I've heard, which you guys are going to hopefully be very inspired by. It is Brain Awareness Month this month, so if you are someone with a brain in your skull, which hopefully everyone listening is, I encourage you to go check out Drink Arepa this month. Go over to their website, drinkarepa.com, and have a look at the neuroscience behind their incredible product. I use this stuff every single day. I take the capsules in the morning. I have the powder in my smoothies for my training, and then throughout the day, I drink the performance and the light and sparkling drink and absolutely love it. I see so many benefits myself and really feel like it just adds so much focus to my mind and allows me to maintain focus on one task for a lot longer. If you use the code GOODHUMAN over on their website, you do get a big 25% off everything. And yeah, I'd love to know what you guys think of the product. So if you try it out, let me know. Also on March 30th, the Saturday at 7 a.m., I'm going to be hosting a mindful morning presented by Drink Arepa, where I'm going to be taking through the community who want to come on down for a free event, through a gratitude practice, a mindfulness practice, and then a fun little activity to finish off the session. It'll be, as I said, completely free across the road from the Salt Mill Coffee Shop at Currumbin Beach. If you go to the link in the show notes of this podcast, you can find the Eventbrite little thing to sign up. It's free, but it's a good way just for us to know how many numbers are coming so we can make sure we have plenty of product and can give you all a bunch of brain drinks. So thanks to Arepa for always supporting me and the podcast. Also, if you want to learn more about my mental health workshops, the last couple of weeks have been huge for me. A whole bunch of different high school workshops and also workshops with corporate groups. You can go over to thegoodhumanfactory.com, click the workshops tab, get a request for a workshop info pack, and my team will be in touch to help you get me in to speak at your school or at your corporate organization. Also, you can use code podcast over on the website for a big 25% off all of our merch. Okay, today's episode, Jack, far out. Oh, has a story unlike anything I've heard. I learned about him through people recommending I should have him on the podcast when I was talking about who should I get, who's a good long distance runner. A bunch of people recommended Jack, and yeah, we got in touch. I learned that he has a mental health organization over in Bali, one of the biggest and most impactful organizations in Indonesia when it comes to mental health. You guys are going to love this chat, but the thing that fascinated me was Jack was addicted to meth from 14 to 18 years old. So there is some heavy topics in this podcast, just a bit of a precursor, but it's just incredible to see how he turned his life around. He went really into depth of how his struggles were through that time of his life, but then also how he turned his life around going to rehab in Bali and then never leaving. He's been sober for 8 years and now he's making such a big impact on so many people's lives. If you enjoyed today's episode, do me a huge favor, share it on your Instagram story or just tag at GoodHumansPod anywhere on your social media so we can see if you're enjoying the episode. Easiest thing you can do, hit like or subscribe. Send this episode to a friend. If you found it interesting, if you found it impactful in your life, then just send it on to somebody else. Leave us a little like or subscribe, 5-star rating and a review. It all goes a long way. Thanks for tuning in. Let's jump into the episode. Welcome to Good Humans Podcast, Jack Ahern.
How you going, brother?
I'm good. How are you going this morning?
I'm very well. I got a little workout in. I had to help my partner out, actually. I had to drop her like an hour from where we live to Byron to drop her off to a modeling job for the day because she doesn't drive. So I did my good deed, dropped my car off to the mechanic, which was perfectly 8Ks away from my house. And I had to do an 8K run today. So I dropped my car off at the mechanic and ran home. So I feel like I was very efficient this morning. And then I mowed the lawn, had my accounting cash flow meeting with my account, and now ready to have a good old chat to you, which is good. How about you? How's your morning?
I just have to say, you know, you're a runner when you've dropped the car and you're running back. Like you've crossed the line. I'm good. I've been sick for 4 weeks, so I'm just getting back into some health and some rhythm. But I was up this morning at 4:30. I ran 17 kilometers and just enjoyed the morning. It's been slow. I get to work in the morning. It's a quiet week this week, thankfully, and just enjoying the nice and peak Bali humidity this March morning.
I know you're in Bali, which is very nice. I actually spoke to my accountant who is in Bali right now, and he was like, oh, you wouldn't believe it, sitting two tables across from me is your sister and Fisher. And I was like, no way, small world, my sister's in Bali right now. And I was just like, what are the odds that my accountant's having a meeting with me on Zoom at the cafe and my sister's like 10 meters from him? Like, world's small sometimes. The other thing I always open my podcast with is, what are you grateful for in life right now today?
Today, I'm grateful for my health, for the ability to move my body this morning, and for, I reckon I say I'm a dog this morning.
Nice. Gotta love it. A little pooch. Yeah. So much joy and happiness.
Most of the time.
Yeah. When they're not shitting everywhere. But man, I'm really excited to have this chat. You're an ultra marathon runner. You're living over in Bali. You do work in the mental health industry. So you're so aligned with me, kind of. You're like the carbon copy of me in Bali right now, almost with the running and the mental health. But you've got quite an amazing story. I did a bit of research before we jumped online. And yeah, I'm really interested to hear how you've got to where you are today, because I know there's been a few chapters that I'm sure you'll probably describe as dark as well. And to bring you back to where you are now in this beautiful life, running marathons, being healthy, helping people with their life and making their life better. So let's go back to the beginning. Tell me about your upbringing. You grew up in Perth, you told me off air quickly, but yeah, what was life like as a kid up until, let's talk, in high school?
Yeah, so I have a very colourful past, to say the least, but actually growing up, I come from a really incredible family. I got sister, brother, supportive parents, good community, good environment. Early on, I was always involved in sport. So I was one of those kids that pretty much came out of the womb with a cricket bat in one hand and then a football in the other hand. And like that was all I did through my whole childhood. Through my early teens was just based around sport and having fun and living that, I suppose, like Australian kid lifestyle and just doing the things that I enjoyed. And actually, I turned out I was half decent at playing sports. So there were, you know, different opportunities that opened up from a really young age, like around 11 or 12, I would have been playing in representative teams for cricket through the summer. And then that would alternate to football during the winter. But like as an actual environment, like I could not find a flaw at all. Like it was just perfect in every sense, from family structure, support, going to school, decent school, friends. There's no bullying. There was nothing like that that impeded my growth as a, you know, preteen and then moving into the early teens stage.
So you had a beautiful upbringing, it sounds like. I'm really intrigued, if you're willing to go into this next part of your chapter, how you ended up in a pretty dark place. So do you want to explain, I guess, what happened once you got to your teen years, what school was like for you, what your sporting career looked like, and then what went on throughout those mid to late teen years?
Yeah, so I experimented with different party drugs. So like it would be ecstasy, it would be alcohol. Like I just got into these things really early on, from around the age of 12, 13, 14. And through this, I'd still be playing sport. So like I'd still be playing footy on the weekend, I'd still be playing cricket through summer. But I was just trialing different substances and there was no specific reason. Like I was just enjoying it. I thought it was fun. I was getting a bit of community around doing those certain things. Where what happened when I was 14, I found myself in a situation where I was around someone that was using methamphetamine and I didn't really know what that was. So this would have been 10 years ago. So it would have been 2014, 2013-ish. So at that time, if you think about substances, it's not as prevalent as it is now. Like if you think about 2013, people weren't talking about methamphetamine. They weren't talking about the harms that, you know, meth or ice can cause to you, your family, the community. And I wasn't educated on what it was. So I just tried it, right? And I thought, wow, this is fun. I'm like, I can do all these other things, but then I can do this. And it was really fun. And yeah, I was a 14-year-old smoking methamphetamine at that time with someone who was 50 years old, right? Like it's a bit of a bizarre scenario. When you look at it from the outside, it's like that's probably shouldn't be occurring. And from the first time I used it, I fell in love with it. Like I really did. I would be within about 2 months to 3 months of when I first used it, it spiraled into a daily use. After about 3 months of just trialing it on the weekend progressed to weekend plus Friday progressed to weekend plus Monday. Within like 3 months, it was something that I was at my best trying to consume every single day. So like I'm 14, 15 years old, trying to, you know, pursue a professional sporting career while smoking methamphetamine pretty much almost every single day.
Just in hiding by yourself, or like I'm just wrapping my head around, young, clean-cut kid that's got beautiful family around him, like no judgment, just like intriguing.
So I through my friend's dad's friend was this 50-year-old man who I was using it with. So I would just be knocking around his house and just compulsively using it in this setting. So I was always running away from home already from like the start, because you put the drug in your system, it just changes you instantly. So I'd be not in my own home, but I'd be doing it there. And just that was my space where I could do it and there's nothing else happening around me.
Mm. Yeah, wow. And still like maintaining playing sport on the weekends and stuff and kind of doing it pretty in hiding?
Well, I thought so. So I remember like early on into it, my parents sitting me down and going like, what the hell are you doing? And I'm like, how the hell can they tell? Like I was really confused. But what I realized is that like you put methamphetamine in your system, it takes away your desire to eat, it takes away your ability to sleep. So you're going to lose weight, you're going to change how you look, your face is going to become more gaunt. Like it's not the easiest substance to hold, to hide from the public visually, because you change so dramatically. So they sat me down and they were like, what are you doing? And I just like flipped at them and went like, you're wrong, I'm not doing it. When in reality I was, but I still was managing to go to school very minimum, like, you know, maybe 40% per week at best, but I was still managing to play football at a pretty high level for the first, let's say, 2 years. Like for whatever reason, I could play intoxicated with that substance and still perform really, really well. That changed post the second year, but for those first 2 years, I thought I was invincible. I was like, I'm doing this, I'm having fun, I'm doing all these activities while I'm using the substance, like I'm enjoying myself and I'm still playing footy at a high level. Like, why would I stop?
Mm. And then what happened? 2 years in, 16 years old, starts catching up to you.
Yeah, so the problem with methamphetamine is that it's a very expensive substance to use daily. Like, yeah, you know, eventually
at the start,
you end up just selling drugs as a means to support the habit. So from early on, I would be selling different substances, and over the 3 to 4 year period I was using it, that just expanded from very minimal amounts to quite large amounts of pretty much every substance possible. And once it became like 2 years into the addiction, it's $1,000 a day that's going through my body. Cool. So I've got to be able to make $7,000 a week just to support the habit to keep me going. And that again, it just started very small. I might be selling a bit of weed, selling, you know, whatever it might be. But by 2-3 years in, I'm 16 years old, going and picking up thousands of ecstasy pills at a time and getting, you know, very, very large amounts of methamphetamine at a time. And I'm going like, well, you know, I got to do this to support my habit. And I'm detached from the action that I'm doing and the harm that that action is going to cause those that I give it to, because I need to do this for me. And around 2 years is where it skyrocketed even more. Like, the use just went up. The criminal activity went up. The people I was around, the quality of them went down, as it does. And the first time I got raided by the police was, I was in year 11 at school and I was driving to go to school, and I pulled out of the corner and there were 7 police cars waiting at the end of the cul-de-sac. And I thought, oh shit, I'm in trouble here. So I've just continued to drive on my way to school. And then, you know, they all get flustered, jump back in the car, chase after us, pull us over, of course. And then, so I'm standing 500 meters from the school that I'm on my way to go to school, and I've got, you know, 7 police cars pulled over, up on the car, hands on the car, getting patted down, dogs through the car, getting driven back to the house I was living at, then having to ask the police for permission to give me my English literature book so I could go to school and then write an essay so that I could pass year 11. That's the chaos of year 11.
Holy shit. All probably while high on meth.
Very, very high. Like, I would estimate that at any given time, I wouldn't have slept for anywhere from 3 to 10 days. That was the usual amount.
Crazy, man.
Yeah.
Crazy. What changed? What, I'm just like, it's so beautiful to see what you're doing now. And like, it's such a great, I guess, way for people watching to maybe relate and see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because it just seems like it was such a quick slippery slope for you with maybe supportive people around you, but just couldn't pull you out of it. So what was the next wake up call? Year 11, did you end up in trouble with that situation, or you went back to school and yeah, was that a wake up call?
No, it wasn't. So I wrote a really good essay that day, believe it or not. I went to school and I did what I needed to do, and I graduated for year 11 to move into year 12. But through year 12 was where the decline of everything really started, and then it was amplified once I graduated year 12 because I didn't have school in the way. But I think it was moving into year 12, I'd really given up on everything. Like, all I wanted to do was to use the drugs, to sell the drugs, and that was all I was trying to do. So around probably the middle of the year, I just said, I'm not really doing school anymore. I trudged my way through the remainder of the year. I graduated through the skin of my teeth, basically with luck, and because the teachers knew that I had potential as an individual, but I'd just lost it over the last 3 years. And once school was done, then I could focus on the drugs full time, which was exciting for me at that moment. But again, from an outside point of view, not the best for me as a human being. Like, I had more time, I had no responsibilities, like I was left to my own, which in hindsight sped everything up, because 3 months after graduating from school, was raided by the police for the second time. And this one was quite scary because they've come in and very kind of like a movie, you know, like they're a bit aggressive, get on the floor, boom, get the weapon out of your hand. I had a screwdriver. I was working on a car. They're like, get on the floor, push you on the floor, standing on your back, hands behind your back, handcuffs, take you into the house, kick everyone out of the house, and then proceed to search the house for eight hours or something.
Wow.
That day was my mother's 50th birthday, but because of the laws, I was a minor at the time. I was 17, so you couldn't place me under arrest or ask me any questions without a legal guardian present. So all the charges went to the other person that I was living with, the 50-year-old person. And so they spent 8 hours trying to manipulate me to unlocking my phone to ring my mum so that my mum could come, and then that they could then proceed to ask me questions and possibly place me under arrest to face the charges for what they found within the house. Uh-huh. And like, I'm like a 17-year-old kid just sitting there like, what the hell? Like, just completely detached from what's happening in this situation. And you would think that that would be a reason to change. Like a normal, if that happened to 99% of the population, they go, you know what, like probably should change what I'm doing. But it took another, that was in February. So it took another.
Get arrested?
He got arrested at that time and placed a whole bunch of charges, distribution of narcotics, all sorts of different things. They found a whole bunch of different drugs. And they placed him under arrest. They released him later that evening. And inevitably, he got sent to jail later that year once I'd actually made the decision to get help. But the problem from that was that the police had seized a whole bunch of substances, which then placed us in some drug debt, which needed to be resolved. It's not the person who sold it to me's issue that I lost the substances. So it was over like a four-month period. Meanwhile, I'm in and out of psychosis. I'm regularly losing touch with reality, regularly thinking and, you know, hearing, seeing and listening to things that aren't real and just really losing my mind. And I had about $10,000 drug debt that was put on top of me that I was responsible to pay, which then caused some people to come to my parents' home, smash my parents' cars. They totaled my mother's car. They scared the living life out of my sister. It's lucky that I wasn't there that day because they would have broken into the house and severely harmed me, which then took my dad actually paying off the drug debt a few weeks later. Like, I had to get my dad, he's the nicest guy in the world, drive me to this house to drop off an envelope full of cash to pay off the drug debt so that I didn't get harmed or they didn't get harmed. This is like I'm 17 trying to deal with this.
Gnarly. Just crazy how quick the slope had happened for you. And yeah, so was that the wake up call once your family got involved? Like, sounds like something out of a movie, man. It's crazy.
It wasn't the wake up call, but it was the accumulation of all the events. So between January 2016 and May 2016, there was all of this stuff happened. So there was the police raid, then there was the fallout because I've lost friendship with all my friends because they think I should go to jail and the other guy's going to go to jail. And then there's the drug debt, then there's the safety of my family, and then that all accumulated. I lost where I was staying. Like, I was really lost. I would sleep wherever I could sleep. I didn't want to go home because I was not well and I didn't want to be around my family when I was like that. But I didn't have anywhere else to stay, so I just bounced around from different houses. I wasn't sleeping once every 7 to 10 days by this stage. And what actually happened to get help was nothing specific. And I believe that, today I believe that like the universe intervened and gave me an opportunity to change my life. And I was just lucky enough to take that opportunity because the day I asked for help, nothing specific occurred. I just woke up one day and went, I've had enough, and went to my mum and talked with my mum about it, and we agreed that rehab would be a good opportunity, would be a good option. So it was, there was no specific thing that day. I just believe it was the accumulation of the last 3 to 4 years, but really the last 6 months of just intensity that, you know, the world just went, you know what, let's give him an opportunity. And for whatever reason, thankfully, I grabbed that opportunity with both hands and said, you know what, I'll take this. I'll try and get better.
How hard was that to ask for help that day?
I'd never done it in my life before.
with
It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life because it goes against everything. Like I'd always controlled my own life and I'd always believed I could get myself out of it. Like I have a will and a desire that now benefits me, but back then I thought I could pull myself out. So to drop the barriers and the, you know, get humble and say, look, I can't help myself with this one is the hardest thing I've ever done. And then to accept it and commit to the help offered, even harder.
Because that's a big thing. A lot of like 90% of people who go to rehab end up back in the situation they kind of went into or something crazy like that. I'm sure you can probably give me a way higher statistic, but a way more accurate statistic, sorry, around rehab and addiction. But what did that next stage look like for you? Because I know speaking to you off air, you said the rehab facilities in Perth in particular, but in Australia aren't that good. Let me know, what that next stage was like. You put your hand out to your family. They've obviously gone through some traumatic stuff themselves due to your addiction and due to that period of your life. What was the next step? And, talk me through that next chapter.
So once I asked, the decision was made, and it was like, well, not only with me but with anyone. When someone asks for help, generally when they're suffering from, you know, let's say chronic levels of addiction, substance use, mental health, that window of opportunity is very, very small, especially when you throw in high-powered narcotics such as like methamphetamine, et cetera. That window is very small before I change my mind and I'm gone. You might not see me for 6 months. So my family just jumped online and it became apparent that there wasn't sufficient treatment options available, not only in Perth, but I suppose Australia as a general. There were a lot of waiting lists. There was a lot of processes. There were a lot of facilities that had, you know, 4 month waiting lists, and we didn't have 4 months. We had about 4 minutes. So it came up to go to Asia. The outside influences of the people targeting my family home and the threats to my general well-being that we thought were real, and they probably were. So it seemed like a pretty good idea just to ship me out of the country for a period of time, like not only for my well-being but my family's. So we found a place. Well, I didn't find it. They found a place in Indonesia that seemed good. I know Bali, it's only 3 hours away from home, and it was affordable relative to like what my family could afford, because treatment is extremely expensive. And again, it just seemed like the right fit. So within 10 days, I was on a plane to Indonesia to go to rehab, and I had absolutely no idea what that meant.
Wow. Yeah. Tell me about that. Had you used in that 10 days, or were you, because I know from speaking to other people who have been addicted to meth, amphetamine, the come down and the, the getting off it is just gnarly.
Yes, brutal. So I'd never had more than 2 weeks sober in like 4 years just because of that. Like the come down, especially once you cross that line of like daily use and high amounts of the substance, the come down is so brutal, and the mental health risk, like with psychosis and schizophrenia and all that, goes through the roof. But I just drank through that time. I didn't use substances again, but I spent basically 10 days looking out the windows. I was just so paranoid. Some warranted, but not fully warranted. I would just be sitting in the bottom room, looking out the windows, peeking out the windows, looking out the back windows, come back, sleep for 20 hours, get up, look through the windows, try and eat some food, just sleep for on a cycle for 10 days, just holding on. Because I knew if I left, I wouldn't come back. Like I knew that. I was able to understand that inside, that if I left, I wouldn't come back.
And that was back at home with your family for the 10 days before you got on the plane?
Yeah. And then jumping on a plane and heading to Indonesia, and like, I didn't even know what rehab it was. I didn't know what rehab even entailed. Like, I just thought, I was 17, uneducated on mental health or addiction treatment as a starting point. I just thought you went to rehab and they fixed you. So I just figured I went there, and then they would fix me, and then I would leave and I could go and continue to drink and do ecstasy and just not use the hard substances, which within about 48 hours of being there, I realized that that was probably not going to be a sufficient treatment modality for myself.
Yeah, well, talk me through that. What was rehab like, walking through the doors of a rehab center at 17, 18 years old, sort of other people around you, bit eye opening. Or yeah, when you said after 2 days you realized this probably isn't sufficient for me, did that come with a bit of education around maybe how deep in it you were and the obvious draw you have towards addiction and drugs?
Yeah, it's a lot. I'd never really assessed the consequences of my use or the hazardous behaviors or like any of the harm that I'd caused. Like I knew that I'd severely damaged my family and I knew the mental health effects that, you know, they suffered as a result. But I didn't really pay attention to anything else because you're so wound up in yourself and your own needs and wants that I didn't really care about anything else. So landing in a rehab, you're kind of like forced to think a lot, and which is a good thing. It's hard, but it's a good thing because you effectively haven't thought for, you know, 2, 3, 4, however many years. And like I'm in this environment, the facility was very small. So it was only like a, let's say, a 2-bedroom house in Australia, you know, but it had 12 people in it. Like it was really, really small. And I found it really scary, but I enjoyed being around these people because I'd been in such a world of toxicity and drug use and crime and negativity. And then all of a sudden I'm in this place where I'm meeting people who are sober and happy. And it was like, huh, like you can do it. And then I'd meet people who'd done more drugs than me that were sober and happy. And then I'd meet people who'd done less that were sober and happy. I was like, huh, like there's something in this. And what I realized was that like within 2 weeks, I was like, damn it, I'm going to be here for a while. Like I'm not dumb. Like I realized within the first few days of like, I'm going to be here probably for 6 months.
Wow.
And I knew that that's what I would require. I held on to the idea that I was only going to be there 2 months, which was the original plan. But like in my gut, I knew instantly I'm like, I'm going to be here for a while and it's where I need to be. And just, it's such a shift from being in, you know, let's say the drug culture to then being in this, like they're the polar opposites. And everything that I found difficult, a normal person would find very easy. But like the thought of having to do my own washing, the thought of having to make breakfast, the thought of having to sleep 7 days a week, the thought of having to make my bed, like all these basic human, well, they should be basic human, you know, requirements to get on with your day. Like I was not able to do them. And I had to like relearn all of that stuff on top of all the emotional development, on top of all the emotional regulation, on top of the physical, mental withdrawal process, all in this environment where I don't know anyone. I got to know them, of course, but in a foreign country, just, you know, really growing up at a rapid, rapid, rapid speed.
Are you the youngest there as well? Because I can imagine it. So like you're so young, you've gone from being a kid really without really growing up. Your first sort of scene of what life is just this drug life and this culture that you've grown up in, really. That 13 to 18 is such developmental years. So you haven't really seen the world of good people out there and a whole different life, what there is. So I can imagine it must have been such a big culture shock for you. Like you said, not only having to do the rehab on your physical and mental health, but also understanding the world and those daily requirements that we have to have as humans, like must have been such a big, big undertaking. What did your day-to-day look like in rehab?
So initially I just did a few different groups, which I'll explain in a second. But after I'd been there a couple of weeks, I caught on to the idea that if you get up early in the morning, you start your day with a bit of intent. And I just forced myself. So I probably never woken up early in my life, like my whole life. So within like 2 weeks, I'd set my alarm for 5 a.m. I'm smoking 60 cigarettes a day at this stage. And
in Bali.
I'd get up. Yeah. So I'd get up and at 5. I had a guy who told me to write 5 things that I'm grateful for. So I started doing that from the very beginning, writing, you know, I'm grateful for my health, I'm grateful for my family, just trying to identify some positives in my life. From the moment I get out of bed, I'd light some incense and then I'd sit and try and meditate for, you know, let's say 5 minutes, 10 minutes, very unsuccessfully. But I found that by putting in the action of positive behaviors, I seemed to benefit from it. I'd then finish that and I'd go and journal for 5 minutes. And some days I'd write, I don't know what to write today, but I've been told to do this. So I'd just be writing this. And then other days I'd be writing, well, today I'm actually feeling pretty good. And my goal today is to do 100 push-ups. And I just drew the people around me and what I found worked for them, and then practicing it myself and becoming really consistent at it. Within 40 days, I had like a really solid morning routine. So I'm like getting up at 5, I'm journaling, I'm writing gratitude lists, I'm doing some work on myself, I'm trying to do a little bit of exercise, and I'm trying to just better myself. Then I'd go to group in the morning where we would just talk about how I'm feeling, what's good, what's not good, which I struggled with. I wasn't able to communicate my needs and wants, and I wasn't able to communicate emotionally what's going on. I still had this idea that I needed to be good and tell you that I'm good. Even in that environment, I really struggled to get vulnerable and express really what was going on. But even just being in that environment and having a crack, it improved while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would do an education group. So we just learn about what is addiction, substance use, what are boundaries, what are healthy communication tools, what is CBT, how do our thoughts dictate our feelings, and all that kind of stuff. And then there would just be lots of free time. So I'd usually spend that sleeping or doing push-ups. Like that was like all I did, sleeping, push-ups and eating in my free time.
Just and no, like no phones and computers and stuff. It was just like full
2 hours per week.
Wow.
Yeah. So every Sunday from 3 to 5 PM, that was it.
And was that like you going to social media back then, or was it like connect and talk to family for an hour or two a week and that was it?
Oh, no, I was get on social media and tell everyone who thinks I'm a fucking dickhead how good I'm doing now, oblivious from the fact that I'm like 60 days into rehab and like, mate, it doesn't mean anything. Like show us for a year that you're doing well. Like look, good on you, but like let's see it for a considerable period of time. There would be a lot of phone calls with my family and stuff, but eventually there's only so much that you can talk about, but it'd be more like, you know, listening to music, jumping on social media, like just trying to tap into what I thought was my life when I returned, which obviously changed.
Yeah, wow. So let's talk about how long were you in rehab for and what was that transition out? And it was 6 years ago now, because there's still lots of your story I want to get up to and talk about you running. But I just think this is such a beautiful story to share, because I know there's going to be someone out there, whether they're your age or whether they're older or somebody knows somebody who's gone through addiction, who can point to this podcast and be like, hey, here's a story of a guy who's gone through it. Here's a few of the stages that he went through. Here you can maybe relate to. So let's talk now on that exit part of the rehab and how you're feeling coming out, what your fears were leaving, and how you ended up in Bali.
Yeah, so I was in there for 6 months. So I did 3 months in the facility full time. It was 8 years ago, not six. 2016. Oh. So I was in there for 3 months, then 3 months in like a halfway house. So I was living off the property, but I would still come in and volunteer. And then after that 6 months, I moved into my own place with the goal to spend maybe another 6 months in Bali or so. That was the estimate. All that I found was that I had good people around me and I had good structure and routine in my life, and I've made them non-negotiables. So like I strove for 100%, which isn't always the best suggestion, but you know, like I wanted 100%. I get up, I do my meditation, I do my journaling, I do my gratitude. I hang around with good people. I see good people in the morning. I see good people in the evening, and I'm connecting with people who understand how I feel, how I think, and can support me in a way that, you know, the general population can't, because I haven't had that lived experience of the troubles. And leaving the facility, like I was riddled with anxiety for at least the next year. Like it took me probably 3 months after leaving, so around 9 months sober, to actually get into a gym. But even once I got into the gym, I still had all that fear around, am I doing it right? Are people staring at me? You know, that negative attachment to being inside a gym. And I just stopped doing it. And then it took my friend actually coming and grabbing me and pulling me in and just helping guide me, the same as I had with my substance. I just needed it with my exercise as well. Like just someone just to tell me it's all right and show me what to do. I knew what to do, but to remove that anxiety and that fear. Mm. And the thing that I did do that really helped through that next year was I just had a go despite how I felt. So even if I was riddled with anxiety, which was regularly, I would still get out of my comfort zone and go and try new things, which was really important to expand my understanding, not only of what life can be, but just through community connections, different things like that. So even if I was really anxious, I just had a crack. So I went and joined the football club over here, which was really important. I went and tried new things. I started surfing. Like, I just, despite how I felt, I had a go. So I didn't sit inside my bubble, which is, I think, can be quite detrimental. It's like getting out of that comfort zone, getting vulnerable and just trying different things.
Mm. Yeah, well, it sounds like it's just such a savior of your life. Like, it could have gone anywhere from where you were to have that realization that day, to wake up, to not get in too much trouble with the police, with the raid, and then have a family that is willing and able to help you. Like, you must be so grateful and feel so lucky to, you know, have gone through what you did, but come out the other side and still have such a positive life ahead of you. So what was that next chapter like? What was that next, let's call it 4 years, like in Bali, and what kept you there?
Yeah, so I just it just all rolled on into each other. I started working in the facility that I was a client. So I'd gone from being a client to then being a staff member. Around that time, I went back to school. So I started doing some study in addiction and mental health, and I just slowly kept ticking different things off as the years went on, and it just kept extending my stay here to where this is home now. I did a diploma in alcohol and other drugs all online while I was here, and then I finished that, and then I went and furthered my mental health education, doing a diploma in mental health, and then I finished that, and then I went, all right, let's go and do a diploma in counseling. I finished that. Then I've gone, you know what, maybe I want to be a mental health first aid instructor in Australia. So I flew back to Oz and did some study in mental health first aid and became an instructor for that. And just continually expanding my knowledge and understanding of the topics that I was in, and just created a life. I created it myself, but it all happened around me. I just allowed it to happen, where, you know, I went from working part-time to full-time to then managing the facility I was a client in, and just one step in front of the other and not getting in my own way, to a point where I just had this life and I was like, oh, well, I've been living in Bali for, you know, let's say 4, 5, 6 years now. It's like, this is my home now. And I just kept moving forward in a positive direction. And, you know, I've been taken care of around that.
Mate, it's so cool to see the turnaround in the life that you're living now. Let's talk about mental health now quickly, the work that you're doing in that. Obviously still working at the addiction center and having an input there, but you've got your mental health organization yourself over there. Do you want to tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I fundraised for food distribution during COVID, which ties in with the ultra running stuff I'll explain after about that. So I did a lot of fundraising for food distribution. We raised enough money to feed 200,000 people during 2020. So a lot of people lost their job here. We raised money so that people could get food. And then after doing that, I'd never done anything like that. I thought, you know what, I want to raise some money for mental health. And then I looked into it, and there was not any organizations within Indonesia that would meet the criteria that I'd be willing to raise, let's say $100, $200, $300, you know, $1 million for. So me and my mate, Nick, we thought, well, why don't we start one? And just from that conversation, we went, all right, let's just start a charity. So we started a charity, and then we're like, what are we going to do? And then we're like, all right, we're going to do this. And we've been going now for 2.5 years. I would like to say we're probably the largest mental health organization in Indonesia that is pioneering free mental health care and free mental health education. So we want to be predominantly in the space of prevention and maintenance and education, because in a country like Indonesia, mental health is taboo and it's not even recognized. It's still treated as a, you know, for example, if you suffer from schizophrenia, you can be tied to chains out the back of your house. That's a common treatment modality. So we work in the space of prevention and maintenance, providing education. We've rolled out a 2-day mental health awareness training that we provide for free. We try our best to promote mental health in a way that is not what they've experienced. So we want it to be positive. We want positive lifestyle choices, changing the perception of mental health. We want people to be able to start conversation, but we want them also to be able to take actions within their life. So one of our mottos is inspiring people to make positive lifestyle choices. And that's basically what we do through community, education, and exercise. So we're tying them all together and giving Indonesians the space to be able to make better change in their life, as well as also being able to provide subsidized counseling services. Because again, that falls more into crisis. It can still be maintenance level, because I think everyone can benefit from counseling if it's the right counselor, but we also subsidize. So like the government would in Australia, we raise funds so that people can have access to free counseling services. It's a big mission that has grown exponentially, and it continues to grow as we have communities on other islands within Indonesia. So we've got one in Manado, which is closer to the Philippines than it is here, and we have another one in Lombok. And we've actually recently just registered as a nonprofit organization in Australia, which is something we'll move towards over the next year to 2 years as well. But from one little idea, it's just grown to something that's making good impact. It's fun, and that's the most important thing for us. If it's not fun, we won't do it. Like we want what we do to be fun, but we just try our best to shine a positive spotlight on mental health, and that mental health doesn't always have to be mental illness, and that we can always do things to make ourselves feel better.
Mate, I absolutely love it. And that's what I said at the start of this chat. I feel like we align so well and have a really similar view on the world on, and especially, to be honest, on mental health, on this idea that it's all about maintenance. It's about those daily habits, those daily rituals that we maintain, even on days where we don't want to. And I think your story is such a great testament to that, that there's going to be days that you don't want to get up, that you want to go back to your old habits, but you don't want to go back to your old life. So it's so important to try and recognize, okay, have that self-awareness. What do I need to do to move forward to the place that I want to be in life, rather than just keep going back on the same patterns? I want to talk about your running now, because I'm guessing it's going to tie quite well into your mental health work and to you understanding probably yourself better. And it's probably going to be something that's really saved you and your mental health along the way. So when did you get into running? Because it's pretty bloody hot in Bali to be running.
Yeah, so I've always ran, right? Like playing footy at a good level, you're always running, but you're not running 10K races. You're not running half marathons. You're not running, distances larger than a marathon. Pre-COVID, I was running more because I was trying to get fit. I was going to come back and play football in Australia. I was going to go and play at Bond University. That's in your part of the neighborhood. So I was on my plan to come back to Queensland, play some footy. I was trying to get fit. I was running a little bit more. And then COVID happens. And I'm like, okay. But I'd enjoyed it. Like I just got, you know, I was really finding some enjoyment in it. So this is like early 2020, late 2019. Like I'm running a lot. And then COVID comes, the island shuts down over here. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to run a marathon. But I don't know what that is. Like I got no idea. So I'd never run a half marathon. So like 4 weeks later, I went and ran a half marathon. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, how does someone run this times two?
Yeah, that's finishing and then going, oh my God, imagine doing that again.
Well, the thing is that I thought that, and then I went back home and then I went, you know what? Like I can do that. And so I skipped the marathon and I went and ran the David Goggins 4x4x48. And I rang my friend Nick. I've gone, I'm going to do this. He goes, he knows me very well. He goes, you're going to find that really easy. Just be aware that you're not going to want to stop when you finish it. And I'm like, nah, it's really hard. And so what he says to me,
David Goggins 4x48.
So you run 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours. So you're running effectively two marathons over 48 hour period. Okay. You're not sleeping in between, and it's only running 6.5 kilometers at a time. But like, I'd never run that distance, but my friend's like, no, mate, you'll be fine. You'll do it and you won't want to stop. And while I was running it, I made the decision that when I finish this, I'm going to run a double marathon. And I hadn't even finished. And this is all on the fly. I'm just coming up with it. So I finished that and I found it really easy. And I'm like, hang on, like I'm actually half decent at this. So then I finished it. We raised a bunch of money through that. That's how we fed, I think it was around 200,000 people. Wow. Through the fundraising of that event. And I've gone, all right, 2 weeks later, I've posted a video. I've said, I'm going to run from the top of Bali to the bottom. which is 84 kilometers, and the first 30 kilometers goes up 1800 meters above sea level. So the total elevation gain of the first 30 kilometers is 1800 meters.
That's big.
And I'm like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to have fun doing it. And a lot of people were like, because this is 2020. So even then, like, ultra running wasn't really, it's very popular now, which is really good. And it's really exciting because I think there's a lot to grow from it. But at that time, it was like, there wasn't an awful lot of it happening.
It's and not a young person's sport. I've learned a lot recently.
Yeah.
But it is becoming.
And even then, yeah, and even then people were like, nah, you're not going to do it, your knees and this. And my mantra was like, no, I will, and I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to smile the whole way. And I went and did it, and again, I had this experience where I was like, damn it, like, it was hard, but it wasn't super hard. Like, obviously it was difficult. There were elements of it, but on a scale of 1 to 10, like, I was like, that's not even close to my ceiling of what's capable. I'm like, this is really fun. I'm enjoying this. I'm going to keep doing it. And
what a pace are you running at for the 84?
I did the total run in 10 hours, and I did the back end 60. So the first 20 is uphill, and then the next 60 in at around 5:40 to 6:15 pace. That is
quick, bro.
Yeah, and I did it through the sun as well. So I was like, I started at 3 a.m. and finished at 3 p.m. And like, I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never run more than 30 kilometers in one go as training for that. Like, I was just winging it. And yeah. I listened to a lot of podcasts. I've got a pretty good knowledge of this stuff, but like, I was winging it in a sense with a little bit of structure, you know, that I'd learned online through listening to different coaches and people online talking. And from that, it's just progressed from that to the next thing, to the next thing. I think I went on after that and I ran 100 kilometers in 12 hours, again, all in the sun. I did that to celebrate 5 years drug and alcohol free. Just continually progressing and progressing and progressing to where now my last year was the biggest distance that I'd done. I've had two goes at 24 hours, which I do over here in September. The first year was 150 kilometers in 24 hours, which really hurt. I enjoyed 90% of it, but it was really, really rough. Like, I learned a lot of lessons and I improved a lot of ways through that experience. But then the second time, which was September last year, I did 170 kilometers in 24 hours in weather that you shouldn't probably run 24 hours. Like, it was that hot. It was incredible. And it just continually progressing from that. Like, I find so much out of it. Like, I just get excited talking about it, whether someone's running 5Ks or whether someone's running 5,000. Like, there's so much to gain from just setting a goal and then doing your best to achieve that goal.
Yeah, man, it's so cool. And I can, like, once again, so many similarities. So this is now where I want to have a bit of a chat to you about some tips for me. So I guess I'll give you a small snapshot of my running history, very similar to yours. Read David Goggins' book and was like, you know what? It's just in my head telling me I'm not a runner my whole life. I was always like, I'm a surfer. It's not good for me. It's shit for my knees. And then I was like, that's literally just the easiest excuse ever. Your head's telling you so you don't have to run. And now that I run quite a bit, I'm like, well, actually, no, I can run and I can maintain an okay pace. And I'm okay. That was just always just a voice. So I'd like ran a little bit through kind of 2020, actually, when COVID hit. I was reading Goggins' book and listening, thinking I was like, cool, doing 5K treadmill runs and a couple 8K loops. And then I did a 30K run, like from Palm Beach to Manly Beach on the northern beaches in Sydney where I grew up. And that was like on a bit of a whim and just did it by myself one morning around like a 5 minute pace. And I was like, oh, that was all right. It was hard, but it was pretty good. 30Ks at 5 minute pace. I was happy. And then I just stopped running and that was like life changed. And I was like traveling a lot for my surfing and I wasn't running. And then I moved to the Gold Coast and I was living on the like route for the the Gold Coast Marathon. And I was like, if I'm ever going to do it, I may as well do it when it runs past my house. So I just went and signed up the day before it. And luckily 3 or 2 years ago, no one was running like they are now. And I could go and just get a bib and do it. Now it's like a wait list massive to get into the Gold Coast Marathon. Anyway, so I just went and did it and did the 40Ks and survived. But on no training, 40Ks is pretty painful on the feet. So yeah, that was painful. And then since then, I haven't really run more than, actually, I did another half marathon. Actually, I've done two half marathons since. Once because both on no training and both were pretty painful. But now with the 100, I've actually got like a running coach. I'm doing 100 days to 100 Ks. So I'm giving myself 14 week training block and learning how like, oh, building into it's good. Like I've done a few 17 Ks after doing 10s and it actually is not that bad and I feel pretty good. So now that you know my brief history of running, I would love to know if you were in my state, in my shoes, because you've done a bit of it now, what sort of advice would you have for me? I've got 11 weeks till I'm running 100 Ks. My training is building quite nicely. I've done like 35, 40, 40 K weeks. And obviously I'll build up for the next 11 weeks. But yeah, any do's and don'ts for what you wish you did when you were getting into it?
Yeah, so like, let's put it this way, right? I haven't had an injury since the 100K run, which was 2021. So that's 3 years.
Wow.
And I haven't had an injury, and my average kilometers between now and then would be somewhere between 80 to 120 per week. Like I don't run that for every single week, but there's the average, it averages out at quite a intensive load most of the time. And the main things that, I mean, you're working with some really wonderful people that we have some mutual friends with that are taking really good care with you and your training plan. And the way that they operate is really high quality because you're not, I mean, watching yours even over the start of the 100 days is just building up on that gradual basis that, you know, the basic rule of 10% each week, having deload weeks, including some strength training into your training, just little things like that. Because what I've done and many other people have done in the past is we're trying to run 6 days a week at a high intensity and our body breaks down where it should be 80% of it at an easy intensity with a little bit of hardness sprinkled on top and not trying to break a record every single day and not trying to go from 0 to 100 kilometers in a week. That's just asking for injury. Like the number one reason I see people get injured is because every single day they're trying to run hard. I'll give you an example. Like I'm in the process of training to run a 2:49 marathon is my goal on the Gold Coast in July this year. So like I've got a reasonable capacity to run fast. And today my easy run was at 6:30.
Wow. Like,
not, which is slower than normal. Like normally it's not that slow, but again, it's removing that attachment to the number and to the, you know, ego attached to the competitiveness that like I ran 17 kilometers this morning in 1:50, which okay, I could run 17 kilometers in half that speed, but it's detaching from, you know, I need to show everyone how fast or how good I am every single time and just doing what's best for my body at that time, which is generally running slower than what we need to, which is
like, which is what I'm really learning. It seems like it's so counterintuitive almost. It's like, oh, surely you want to like be running hard, but it's like, no, you want to build. And that's what I'm learning. Like I've got a friend of mine who hit me up going like, hey, I want to do a challenge and run 50K next week. You in? And I straight away was like, fuck yeah, this will be good for my training, like epic. But then I showed it to Jai, my running coach. He's like, nah, if you want to do the 100 good in 12 weeks, you're not just going to bang out 50 just for the sake of it because you want to as a challenge. Do 25 and then get on a line bike and ride next to him for the rest of it because your challenge is 100K coming up, not 50K right now. And I was like, I like sometimes because I'm a sort of guy that's just like, got the sort of fuck it mentality. So to have people like yourself and people like Jai around me. And that's why I think doing this podcast and doing this 14 week 100 day to 100K project is so beneficial because I know there's going to be people listening who are like me that are going, okay, it actually does need to be planned out to do it in a way that's healthy and to do it in a way that's going to be more enjoyable and not just painful the whole time.
Yeah. Like I had a run coach first one like a few years ago, then I thought, you know what, like I want to get into doing this, and I went to Athletics Australia and did a whole lot of study and learning around all this stuff. And the biggest things that always come away is just it's that same thing, because generally, like, all right, if you've signed up to do a 100K, you could go and run 50Ks for sure, but it's like, how long does it take you to recover after that? Exactly. Does it push you back 2 days? Does it push you back 4 days? Does it increase your risk of injury by 10%, or does it increase it by 60? Like I'm in the same boat. I've got some friends doing 12 marathons in 12 days and I would absolutely love to do it. Like, I'm 99% sure that physically I could, but it's like, all right, I've got a marathon on April 7 and this challenge is in March. Would that be optimal for my performance in April and would it even be optimal for my performance in July in Gold Coast? It's like, no. So it's the same as what Jai suggested to you. It's like, all right, I can run one marathon with them because I can still have it as a, you know, extended long run as a training, but the day before, maybe I'm gonna have to ride a bike with them. And yeah, just dropping the ego and just going like, all right, what's the bigger picture? What's the goal? What's going to benefit me best for whatever my goal is? And that's taken me some maturity with this stuff to understand that and learn it and trial and error, find out, you know, what is the more appropriate way to go.
Yeah. No, man, I appreciate it. I think it's just, I feel like I'm just adding to this little cup of Cooper's 100K experience and getting little sprinkles from different people and reaffirmation from different people from each person, which is, it's been a massive help, man. But, bro, I feel like we could chat for ages and I want to have you back on one day. Hopefully we can catch up in person when I'm next in Bali or you're over here in Australia, because I'd love to have a run with you. And I feel like we've got so many things in common and I just feel like you've got such a big heart and I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story, because I think your story was something up until 20 minutes before I bloody clicked record on this podcast, I had no really idea about, to be honest. I had quickly looked on your social media, just did a bit of research and found an old podcast you're on and went, wow, this is going to go a completely different direction than I thought. And I'm really happy it did, because I know as much as people are going to get so much out of the running part of your story and the impact that the running has had on your life and helped you, I guess, turn around your life and giving you that purpose and thing to wake up for every day, I think there's going to be people who have got a family member, have got a friend, have got somebody in their life that has gone down that dark path. And I love having these conversations, because I hope it can drop judgment on for people, because I know so often you hear about someone who's addicted to meth and straight away it's just like this negative connotation to it. But things can happen. People can slide down this path unassumingly with the wrong guidance, or the not even wrong guidance, just the lack of guidance and the lack of inner awareness and self-awareness at a young age, and go down that path. So I think hearing your story is a great one for people to maybe drop that judgment they might have of that family member, they might have of that relative or somebody in their life that is going down that path of addiction, and maybe be able to lead them in the direction to listen to this episode, or at least show that there is, or them feel that there is light at the end of the tunnel for people who they think might be down a path that they think isn't returnable from. So I really appreciate it, and thank you for sharing your story, my man.
I appreciate it, because it's the number one thing that there isn't enough of is vantage points. You need that vantage point that you can do it, it is possible, or your brother can do it, or your husband can do it, or your wife can do it, or your sister can do it, or the person down the corner of the street can do it. Like, there is hope that they can do it. And that's just, because if there's no hope, what's the point? But just, you know, try my best, like other people as well, just to be a vantage point that, hey, like, if you really do want to make change in your life, it is possible. And the only thing stopping you is just making that decision and reaching out and getting into it.
Well, I think hearing your story is going to give people plenty to sort of hope for and see that, you know what, there is this other life on the other side of addiction. What seems like maybe everything in your life at one stage can completely turn around and mean absolutely nothing to you in your life, and then have so many other things that mean a lot to you, which I can see your life is full of now, which is really beautiful, man. I do finish all of my Good Humans podcasts with the same question, and I'm keen to hear what you have to answer to this. So what does being a good human mean to Jack Ahern?
There's two answers. The first one is not repeating the behaviors that I used to repeat. So it's something that I'm really important is that I, you know, how do I can never right the wrongs of the things that I did to certain people, places and areas of my past. So it's a big thing not to repeat those behaviors, and whether they're aware of it, I'm aware of it, then I'm not doing those things anymore. And the other side of it is just doing the best I can on that day. So that can be really good some days, and that can be really poor other days, but just doing the best that I can at that time.
Mate, that is so well put. I love the first part of that answer. Not repeating the same mistakes that we've made before is so important, and having the self-awareness to recognize that it's your mistake sometimes, when so often we blame it that it's other people's doings, recognizing that, you know what, these things are my mistakes and I have to take responsibility to change them. So I think that's a beautifully put answer. So thanks so much for jumping on. Last thing, if anyone wants to find you on social media, your websites for your charity or anything, now's a chance to plug it. I can put it all in the show notes as well. So yeah, where can anyone find you online to get in touch if they want to learn more about your journey, follow the journey? And yeah, I'm sure you're willing to get back to people if they're going through something when it comes to addiction as well.
So mine is Jack Ahern. That's my handle for all things. And then Shuffle and Strides is the name of our organization. So that's the main way to find it is through Instagram, but we're always available through either of that, my page or that page as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, brother. I appreciate your time and thanks for sharing your journey.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.